Voices.
Want to see the world from a totally different perspective?
Ready for provocative conversation?
Intriguing stories?
And inspiration?
Then don't touch that dial.
Welcome
to Talk with Francesca.
She'll give you something to talk about all week long. Now, here's Francesca.
What if you took the time to really soak it?
Welcome to Talk with Francesca. I'm Francesca. For more information, check out my website, talkwithfrancesca.com. And if you want my weekly truth serum, you can simply sign up by going to my website. Or you can also send me an email at info@talkwithfrancesca.com with questions or comments. I love to hear from you, as always. You can also find me on Facebook, where you can send me questions if you'd like to chime in. All right, let's just dive right in. How do people make decisions, and why do they make bad ones? This is Dan Ariely's, a professor of psychology at Duke University's field of expertise. Do you know why we sometimes find ourselves excited about buying things we don't really need? I would personally love to know why I go to Christmas tree shops, spend the money, and then throw it away 6 months later. But anyway, we'll hold that question for a few minutes. I call it actually mindful meditation. And when you get something free, you probably don't place as much value on it. Do you have any idea why? Do you know why we still have a headache after taking a cheap aspirin, but why that same headache vanishes when the aspirin costs more? I'm just going to keep going with a couple more questions. Do you know why people who have been asked to recall the Ten Commandments tend to be more honest, at least immediately afterwards, than those who haven't? Or why honor codes actually do reduce dishonesty in the workplace? Well, we all make decisions every day, ranging from what we should make for dinner to what purpose our life has. And you would think that we approach all of them rationally and logically, but you're wrong. Irrational behavior is part of human nature, but as Dan Ariely has discovered in 20 years of research, people tend to behave irrationally in a relatively predictable way. He is the author of Predictably Irrational and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, and he's here with us today to discuss those questions and more. So by the end of this hour, you might just have the answers to many questions that have implications for your personal life, your business life, and for the way you look at the world. So don't be irrational. Don't touch that dial. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us today on Talk with Francesca.
My pleasure.
So let's just start with a brief thumbnail sketch of why you started with the research. And part B of that question is, what was the most surprising findings, Dan?
So I started looking at irrational behavior because of personal interest. So as you know, I was badly burned when I was 18, and I spent about 3 years in hospital. I was burned in about 70% of my body, and everybody gets small burns, and these usually go away, but severe and deep burns are a very, very different story. And I noticed lots of things in hospital that made me puzzle, but the thing that troubled me the most every day was the question of how you remove bandages from burn patients. Mm-hmm. And the question, you can think of it in one way, is do you remove the bandages quickly, trying to minimize the time, but every second is going to be very painful, or do you take the bandages off slowly, take a long time?
Ooh, that's I got a visual going. What do you think, listeners? Right, all I can envision is waxing. Ouch.
That's right.
Right.
So many women think about waxing, and it turns out it's it's the wrong metaphor, because waxing deals with hair, and hair has a very different dynamic. So when you wax hair, the piece just comes out with actually creating less damage. But when it's skin, it adheres to the bandage adheres to the skin all over. The solution is different. And then it turns out that the quick ripping approach is a bad approach. Now, my nurses, I think they had intuition based on waxing, but they thought that the right approach is the quick ripping approach, but it turns out they were wrong. And the way I know they were wrong, because when I left the hospital 3 years later, I started doing experiments on this. So I would bring people to the lab, and I would hurt them for different durations and different intensities, and I would try and figure out empirically what makes people suffer more and suffer less. And it turns out that the nurse was just empirically wrong. And this kind of made me wonder. I went back, I talked to the nurses about this. And one of my favorite nurse, she said, first of all, she said was that I did not think about her pain. She said, what about her? She was there removing my bandages. This was no picnic for her either. Maybe she was just trying to get out of there.
But was she, let me just...
No. She was not serious.
She was, okay. You answered. But, you read my mind.
She basically said, you know, maybe it was an unconscious influence of her personal desire because, you know, the nurses in the burn department, I have to say, have a really tough job. It is terrible to cause such torture to people who are just screaming and shouting when they do this to them. By the way, things have gotten much better. Narcotics have gone much better. And these days, sometimes they take people with my level of injury and just knock them out for the first 9 months of their... Like, just basically put them to sleep for all that duration so they don't are not aware of anything.
So this is actually how you started to get involved in this research.
That's right. And I started... So the first thing was with, you know, this nurse. She said, oh, you maybe it was for my... But then I said, why don't you just try it my way? And the way she said it was actually very informative for me. She said every day she had a choice. She could do what she was taught, which is the quick ripping approach, what she thought was good for her, the quick ripping approach, what she thought was good for me, the quick ripping approach, or she could try something different, something she had no idea about. But her gut intuition was telling her that the quick ripping approach was the right way. But here's the thing. Her gut intuition was wrong, and the gut intuitions of all the nurses are wrong. And this idea became very important for me, is what if we have strong gut intuitions about things we have no data about, mm-hmm. and the gut intuition is so powerful that we never try anything else? And from that point on, I started looking at all kinds of cases in which we think we know what the right answer, but we don't, and we make the wrong decision time after time after time. And I don't look as much at pain anymore. I look at things like how do we make decisions about saving and spending and how we make decisions about honesty and who we deal with and trust and all kinds of other things. But the basic principle is this question of under what conditions do we have good intuitions and under what conditions are intuitions just faulty? Let's figure out empirically, scientifically, and then let's use that to make better decisions.
It's interesting because, I've always thought for the longest time it's that gut instinct that we so often talk about. And are you saying that a gut instinct possibly could be wrong?
Absolutely. And many, many times. So if you think about gut intuition, you could say, under what conditions could your gut know something? Well, you would have to do something many times. You would have to do them in different ways every time. So you have a variance. You have sometimes to succeed, sometimes to fail. And you would have to get immediate, quick feedback about that. Mm-hmm. So think about something like dating.
I actually just was, because I used to, many moons ago, own a dating service. And it made me think about when people would call and say, oh, I had a great time. And, oh, I had butterflies. Oh, I can't eat. Well, that's not necessarily positive, right? If you can't eat and there's that feeling of supposedly love, but you can also, right? Right?
So think about gut intuition. You meet somebody for coffee mm-hmm. for 15 minutes, mm-hmm. and based on that, you have a gut intuition. Now, it's very powerful, so it's hard to ignore, but is it accurate? You know, personally, I think I'm the kind of person who grow on people over time. I think that, you know, immediately...
Well, you are very funny.
Thank you. But you know, I think that, you know, there's some people who do well in bars, right? Some people who just are immediately handsome and charming and so on.
Right.
But I think most people are not like that. Most people kind of... It takes some time to get to know us, to care, to understand what we are, a little bit quirky, a little bit strange. Now, those people are not necessarily going to be making good first impression. But what you want with somebody you're going to stay with for a long time is not just the first impression. You want to think about what it is that would sustain a deep emotion of caring and camaraderie and love and romantic attraction.
Well, absolutely. And also when you first meet someone, they can be very nervous. And so they may not be at their best.
Yeah, but even if they're not nervous, what do you know about them?
Exactly.
You know something very, very superficial. So it's very hard to meet somebody for 5 minutes and not feel that I have a gut feeling and that my gut feeling is informative. Mm-hmm. But I think it's actually not. And, you know, it's very hard to study this because it's really about the long term and it's really hard to force people to be together long term. But we have two kind of things that we do this. One is arranged marriages in India. So there's a study about arranged marriages in India, looking at arranged marriages compared to what's called loved marriages. And what they show is that the people with love marriages start much happier than the people with the arranged marriages, but the people with love marriages go down over time, and the people with the arranged marriages go up
over time. Now, why would that be?
So the thing is that the people who are marrying over love, they capture something essential that is important for the short term. But the people that get married in arranged marriages, their families are helping them. And their families are not thinking short term, they're thinking long term. And by the way, there's a crossover in year three. So after year three, the arranged marriages, people are happier. There's another example in the U.S. In the U.S., the only time when we force people to be together is either in the military, of course, or in college dormitories. And many undergrads report that when they first met their college roommate, this was not their favorite person in the world, but they became lifelong friends afterward. And those are kind of few examples to show you that what makes somebody valuable in your life is not necessarily the thing that you catch on immediately. I'll give you one more thing about dating we did. So, you know, if you think about dating sites describe people in the same way that we describe nutritional information, height and weight and, you know, religious affiliation and do you have a sense of humor and so on. And the question is this kind of description helps us to make better decisions about whether we would like the other people or not? So we went to people and we say, please give us a list of people you really love and a list of people you like so-so. Not hate, but just not the same.
Right.
And we went to these people and we asked them to fill their information as if it's an online dating website, without a picture and without their name. And then we said, okay, let's take this list of people, half of them people they love, half not, back to the person who originally gave us the list, and let's see if they can sort them into people they like or not like. And they couldn't. Why? Because if you think about it, you take all the people that you really love, what would it be on their online dating site, website, information that would tell you that you love them? What would be? Would it be the eye color? Would it be the height, the weight, the political affiliation, right? None of those things really explain to us what eventually make us lifelong friends of people. I don't know about you, but if I look at my best friends, like the biggest group is from first grade. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in Israel, but really a long time ago. And these are people that I have tremendous loyalty and care and affection, and we meet every time. And it's, you know, we don't feel like first grade, but we do go back in age. And it's hard to imagine that there's something about them that would be described in an online dating website or in any kind of on Facebook that I would say, yes, this is the kind of person I would like to be a lifelong friend with. So we are. The things that get us to be love people over the long time are not necessarily the things that we see in our gut intuition. And then there's lots of other examples, of course, but I think dating is kind of a good one because we just have such strong miscalibrated gut feeling.
Oh, absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talk with Francesca, and I'm speaking with Dan Ariely, who is a professor of psychology at Duke University. I've got a question that I've always been very curious about, so I can't help but have to ask you this. Why the heck do we care so much about what other people think of us? I mean, it seems our very nature, we're wired to kind of compare, and I've always been very, very curious about that. I'd like to think that other people's feelings about me is really none of my business, but I have to admit that I do care about what other people think, and I think most people do.
Yeah, it's very hard not to, and for multiple reasons. So, first of all, it turns out that across all of human activity, we are very much attuned to relative rather than absolute performance. And you can think about something physiological like light. If you're in the sunlight versus in a room that is, you know, lit by a light bulb, the absolute amount of light is unbelievably high, like maybe 100,000 times more light outside than inside. But your system basically adjusts to that, and you just look at relative changes.
Mm-hmm.
This is
now we're
white
onto something,
paper.
Listeners. Listen close.
So we do that. So our system in general, our brain, extracts lots of relative information. We do it for light. Mm-hmm. We do it for weight. And one of
we
the
do it
relative
for the stock
things,
market, the
yeah,
new
yeah.
norm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things is to basically see where we stand compared to other people. And it's a very natural thing. I can ask you, how successful are you in life? And you could say, I don't know what it means. Right? What does it mean to be successful? Is it how long I'm going to live? I mean, I don't know. But let me look at the people around me, and that would give me a yardstick to evaluate how successful I am.
Yeah, but I tend to look at the people who are more successful than me rather than less.
Yes, and that's not a good thing, right?
Well, because then I never feel like I, you know, I feel like I always have further to go.
That's,
you know,
right.
And
so
I try to compete
motivated.
With myself, but I can't help. Inevitably, there is a little bit of that competitive nature in me.
That's right. So you know, looking at women's magazine and only the most beautiful women is, you know, it's motivating to some degree. But also disheartening because you don't feel that you've arrived. So there's
right.
there's an interesting, delicate balance there. But we have a very hard time not comparing ourselves. And then, of course, there are some things where comparison is real. So think about something like schools. If you want to send your kids to good schools, you basically want to go to a place that has a high real estate taxes. Because real estate taxes in most places are the things that fund public schools. So what you want to do is you want to buy a house that is better than other people so you can send your kids to a better school. So there are some cases in which the competition is actually a real competition. Like, you know, you can like you can have, okay, a bigger car than you, a bigger car or bigger house. That's like... Everybody can do that. I mean, of course, it's expensive and time consuming and so on, but schools have a limited size. They are
right.
limited in resources, and now the competition is actually very, very meaningful. So I'll give you a funny example for this. I have my kids are 11 and 7, and a few years ago we realized that the birthday parties for kids were just getting out of hand. So, you know, there was one parent who was doing a birthday cake, and then the other one had a clown, and the other one had a birthday cake and a clown and sushi for the adults, and the next one had clowns, this, and something else. And just, you know, everybody just wanted to up everybody else. Now, the kids in reality just wanted cake and to run around a little bit. But there was this competition that basically escalated these birthday parties out of hand, and that's a natural human tendency. We just want to be as good, if not better, than other people, and we're willing to lose lots of money for this privilege.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting because I hate to admit such a thing, but and I don't believe I am one of them, but I do believe that there are people who out there who are secretly smug and kind of delighted when people of all things perfect and unattainable enter the world of all things that pretty much suck. You know, it's sort of like there was a guy I interviewed a while back who wrote a book called Why People Love a Good Train Wreck. And it's a terrible thing, but I mean it does seem that people do take some joy in that, and I find that unsettling and wondering why that would be.
So
I mean, misery loves company, I suppose, right? Right.
So I think there's a couple of versions of this. So if you look at the car accidents,
that
we can't help but look when it happens and we slow down and the whole traffic stops down. This I don't think anybody is really happy when somebody
else is
in a car accident.
Right.
But I think it is educational in the sense that it does help us learn something about the world. Right? We learn how cars flip over and what is dangerous and what can happen to a car if it crashes. And I think it's this curiosity. And curiosity, by the way, is a very interesting urge. So when I was 12, my mother had this really amazing approach to how to raise us. Okay, so now I'm guessing you're thinking about my mother.
Right.
I don't have anything to say about my mother. I mean, she's a great woman. I just made this up.
Okay, well, I actually have questions coming through like crazy here, and I'm trying before our break to see if I can get something.
The thing is that your curiosity has just picked up. About my mother, right? It will be very hard for you not to think about my mother for the rest of the show.
Right.
So curiosity is a very, very strong human motivator. And then sometimes we want other people to put other people down because we want to feel relatively more successful. So it's really nice, I think, when celebrities have a terrible life, so you don't have to feel bad about it. You can say, oh, I'm I'm not as bad. My life is quite good in comparison.
Just a total side note here. You've got a lot of people reading your book. I actually happen to be one of them. And but I'm curious, is it ever hard for you to stop analyzing and just kind of relax? Or do you find yourself that you just sort of can't help it? It's become part of your DNA.
Yeah, it's
part of your DNA.
It's continuous.
And, it's sort of interesting. It's become part of you, so that's cool.
And it's wonderful and it's difficult. And actually, it's kind of interesting how other people who know me now react to me. I do lots of little experiments, and people always think there's some experiment going on them.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Dan, what about the great law of human? Sort of attraction, that in order to make a man want you, you just necessarily have to be difficult to attain, or vice versa. It can be the other way around as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So this goes back to what's a very well-known phenomenon called cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
And cognitive dissonance is the idea that we don't really know what we like and don't like, and we look at the effort that we put into something as an indication of that. So if I get you to work very hard for something, you later look at yourself and you say, why did I work so hard for something? And then you say, oh, it must be because I love this person, I love this house, I love this so much. And therefore, it's easy for us to convince ourselves that putting effort into something indicates great love. And therefore, playing hard to get is a good strategy.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got more stuff to talk about, but have to take a short break. I've got a bunch of questions actually coming in through Facebook. I'd like to address those. And then I'd like to talk about, hopefully, if we have time, why we lie and cheat, eat chocolate, and do things with horrendous consequences. So don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. You can be amazing. You can turn a phrase in. Want to know the best-kept secret north of Boston? The beautifully manicured Nine Hole Nahant Golf Club is a no-brainer for a great place to relax, dine, and unwind. John Moore, owner of the famous Navy Yard Bistro and Wine Bar in Charlestown, has opened Seasons Restaurant at the Nahant Golf Club. Come for golf and great food and stay for the community feel. Meet old friends or make new ones. Visit Seasons Restaurant at the Nahant Golf Club today and enjoy the seasonally inspired menu serving lunch and dinner with live music on the weekends. Nahant Golf Club, 1 Willow Road in Nahant. Now what are you waiting for? Located in Boston's North End holds one of our best-kept secrets, Antico Forno, ranked number 9 of the top 10 Italian restaurants around the world within the category of being one of the most authentic. With a welcoming family feel, it's hard to argue the experience you have when enjoying dinner at Antico Forno. Best known for their brick oven pizza, their world-class traditional cuisine does not fall far behind. Come enjoy dinner at Antico Forno and feel like part of the family. Open daily from 11:30 a.m. until 10 p.m. Call us today at 617-723-6733 or visit us at AnticoFornoBoston.com.
Tides is beachside dining at its best all year round. Located at the end of the Nahant Causeway, directly on Nahant Beach, the ocean views from the dining room and the pub can't be beat, no matter what the season. Nominated for Best of the North Shore from North Shore Magazine for Best Alfresco Dining, Best Kid-Friendly Restaurant, Best Lobster Dinner, and Best Water View. Why would you go anywhere else? Whether you choose their dining room, a frosty pint at their bar, or a sun-drenched deck on Nahant Beach, they guarantee you great atmosphere with super food and service. Their menu is full of fresh, high-quality seafood, prime rib, chicken, pasta, and pizza that everyone will love. Check out their drink menu for fun cocktails, 30 ice-cold beers on tap, and their well-rounded wine list with their state-of-the-art tap wines. They feature full-service lottery and keno. Tides is the place to watch any big game. They have over 20 HD TVs. At Tides, they specialize in casual dining with food that's just delicious, not pretentious. Tides is a fantastic restaurant anytime, summer or winter, lunch or dinner, rain or shine.
Are you looking for an authentic Italian meal in an intimate setting? Then you'll want to dine at Terra Mia's. This North End Italian restaurant provides a simply divine culinary experience and, as quoted in Zagat's restaurant guide, pastas without compare. And it's reasonably priced. This North End gem will keep you coming back. Terra Mia is simply the best Italian restaurant in all of Boston. Call 617-523-3112, 617-523-3112, or terramiarestaurante.com. Have you wondered about what it would be like to host your own radio show?
Perhaps it's to help your business or organization, or maybe it's to help the community. Perhaps it's a hobby you'd like to pursue. Whatever the reason, I can help you. I'm Francesca Luca, longtime radio host of the radio show Talk with Francesca, and I have coached many radio hosts to make their dream a reality, and I want to help you too. Stop wondering and find out today how to turn your idea into a radio program. Visit talkwithfrancesca.com and fill out the contact form, or call me at 978-880-5740. I look forward to talking with you about your ideas.
Hey, this is James Woods, and you are listening to Talk with Francesca every Saturday morning.
Okay, we're back with Dan Ehrlich, professor of psychology and the author of Predictably Irrational and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Welcome back, Dan.
My pleasure.
All right, I wanted to ask you, I do want to know why we're so dishonest, but I do want to address some of the questions that we've got that's been coming through. What can you say about superstition? Is it someone who is not putting their name but wants to know what you make of superstition? So I'm curious about that too. So that's a good start.
So superstition is an interesting human psychology, mm-hmm. and it's really about the fact that we are looking all the time for logic in what's going on around us. So you know how at the end of each day there are these people on TV. At the end of each day, there are these people on TV that tell you what the stock market did today. And they tell you a story about why this is exactly is what they thought, and they analyze it. And we did a study in which we gave people that information, and we gave them the opposite information, and they found all of it that convincing. So IBM stock went up because IBM bought stocks. Oh, yes, that sounds reasonable. Because they sold stock, oh, yes, that sounds reasonable. We're looking for explanations all the time. Our brain is trying to make sense of the world. Now, here's
everything,
what happens.
And not just with everything, right?
With everything.
Yeah. You're personally always trying to come up with a story.
That's right.
Of what is,
the stories,
right?
And the stories that we tell are deterministic and not random. So it's not as if we say, oh, there's 75% chance that this will happen. We're looking for stories that says X causes Y. So now imagine you're a baseball player and you play baseball and you did not change your underwear for 2 days and things worked out well for you. What do you say? Do you say, I have no idea what happened?
I can start wearing dirty underwear to play baseball.
Right.
Oh, jeez.
So superstition is all about the fact that something happens in proximity to something else, and we attribute it to this. I'll give you one, probably the worst example, kind of in what we're doing right now, is lots of people stop immunizing their kids. Mm-hmm. So here's what happens. From time to time, kids get sick, and it's a terrible thing that happened. And from time to time, kids get sick after they got immunized. And it's impossible for parents to say, well, the kid just got sick or something happened. Instead, they say it must be the immunization that caused it. And they make this causal relationship with something that is not causal, but it's almost impossible. I think of myself, right? If my kids got sick,
right.
It would be very hard not to blame something concrete and specific that happened differently in their lives, even with everything we know about immunization. So we have this desire to explain the world in simple deterministic terms, and that creates superstition. So very quickly, you know, we could do something two or three times, and, you know, something can be just random, but nevertheless, we take this very seriously and we start behaving this way.
Well, I have to admit, I am a hair superstitious. As a matter of fact, I bought some allergy medicine today before I came to the station, and the change came through one of these little, I don't know what you call them, but they're not handed to you. They're in a little pot there. And there were two panties left, and one had the head upside down, and one had the head up. I took the one with the head up. I wasn't interested in the one that was down.
That's good to know.
And I actually have a sort of a crazy thing that happened to me years ago. I was renting a art studio, and I looked at, somehow or another, I glanced down at the floor, and there was a penny with the head down. And I said to myself, oh, no, that's not a good sign, but I love this art studio. I've got to rent it. I've just got to do it. And I did it. Well, you know what? I wasn't there 3 months. There was one bad thing happening after the next. There was tar dripping down from the ceiling. Oh, it was just one thing after the next. I finally moved out. And just before I moved out, it turned out that the building went, you know, kaput.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, so I'll be damned if I'm touching a penny with the head down.
There you go.
Okay. And you know what? My listeners might think I'm crazy. But anyway. All right. So I've got a couple questions coming through. Rebecca from Haverhill would like to know, oh boy, I can't stand these cable companies' tactics, but they must be accomplishing their goal. How do they get us to spend so much for so little? That's a good one.
Yeah. So,
they get some damn good marketing people, right?
Yeah. There's all kinds of things that they do. So one thing, of course, is that they really don't have open competition. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that they use wonderful, amazing tricks. For example, when I lived in Boston, there was an ad for their local cable company that says free cable. And when you read the little print, it turns out it's not the real deal. It wasn't free. And what happened was, if you got installed the standard cable and you agreed to pay them for 2 years,
of course,
they would pay you the difference between the silver level and the gold level back for 1 month. So, you know, for $78, you could get the upgrade for $20 for free. I mean, so they're using lots of tricks. And then, of course, there's switching cost, because you know, it's really, really tough. So I tried to disconnect our cable not too long ago. And first of all, it's incredibly tough. You have to call lots of people. You have to have lots of time.
Oh, I know. It's like, you know, yeah. Not and my then, monkey, not my problem, you know?
That's right. And then on top of that, you have to take your devices and give it back to them in their office, which is somewhere far away.
Or so, you will end up having to have an extraordinary amount of money taken from you, right?
I know. That's right.
These guys are criminals. This is called white collar crime, and we'll get into that too.
I think that what they're doing is they are under the heading of maximizing shareholder value. And under the heading of maximizing shareholder value, they are justifying lots of things that I think are very, very hard to justify in terms of thinking about the benefit of their consumers. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that it's a really good justification story, maximizing shareholder value. And they are maximizing shareholder value, right? Because they charge so much and they get paid, and they get paid so much. And because all of them are like that, yep. It's not. I've not yet met somebody who said they love their cable company.
Oh, I don't hear about anybody loving, but I hear a lot of people saying that they hate their cable company.
That's right. But if nobody loves them, it means that the competition is they're all the same, right? So it's not as if you can move to a loved company. So I think it's tough. The other thing I have to say, kind of in defense of the cable companies, is that we only see
them when dare. You'll make a lot of enemies. No one will be buying your book if you defend the cable companies.
That's fine. Let me in the spirit of being truthful. I think it's one of those things that we see when they make mistakes, and we don't see them when they're doing things the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, of course.
When your cable just runs smoothly, mm-hmm. you know, lots of amazing technology is at your service. Right, they send you programs. They do all kinds of things. They get it on time, quickly. It's not as if it's free, right? They put a lot of effort into it. Their infrastructure is really quite impressive. They do all kinds of things, but you don't see that. And the only place you see it is when something goes wrong. And partially is that they don't tell you how much work they do for you.
Right. Okay, so, all right. They're loving you right about now. We're going to get them to advertise on Talk with Francesca.
Very good.
Dan, let's talk a little bit about white-collar crime. You know, I was getting a big kick out of that one. You know, it's like stealing stuff from the office and that kind of thing. And, you know, it's just amazing how people think that, you know, they can cheat on their taxes, but they're totally dishonest, but they would never, you know, not if the girl at the cash register gave them back too much money, they would give it right back to them. You know, so there's sort of an interesting entirely different dynamic that goes on there. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So we've done lots of experiments on dishonesty. And the basic way that we measure dishonesty is the following. We give people a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems, and we say, solve as many of those as you can in 5 minutes, and we'll give you a dollar per question. So we said, go, and people start working as fast as they can. At the end of the 5 minutes, we say, stop, please put the pencil down and tell us, sorry, put the pencil down and count how many questions you got correctly. And now that you count how many questions you got correctly and you know the answer, take your sheet of paper, go to the back of the room and shred it. And people shred a piece of paper. And then we say, now come back to the front of the room, tell us how many questions you got correctly, and we'll pay you accordingly. So people do that. Mm-hmm. And they say on average they solve 6 problems and we pay them $6. But what the people in the experiment don't know is that we played with the shredder. So the shredder only shreds the sides of the page, but the main body of the page remains intact. And we can find out...
Who's lying?
Well, yeah, that's right. But it's for science.
Oh.
So we can find out how many questions they really solve correctly. And what we find is that on average, people really solve 4 problems, but they report to be solving 6.
Now, why would that be?
Okay. So the first question is to say, where is it coming from? Is it coming from a few big cheaters? No. It's coming from a ton of little cheaters. We tested, you know, close to 40,000 people so far, and we found only about 20 big cheaters, and they stole maybe $500 from us. And we found tens of thousands of little cheaters that stole about $60,000 from us.
Mm.
So the reality is that there's so many little cheaters. And again, it's just like you said, there are people mm-hmm. cheat a little bit on their taxes and so on. And those things really make the difference in terms of dishonesty. Now, why is it?
What about expense reports, right?
Oh, expense report, an amazing celebration of dishonesty.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of like the boss says to the guy, hey, give me back your expense report and have it right this time. What do you mean? It's
yeah.
Right, you know. And
expense reports are amazing. And they're amazing because they allow us to play tricks on ourselves. And, you know, there's lots of flexibility in expense reports. So you're on a business trip and you meet somebody in a bar and you buy them a glass of wine.
Oh, but we did talk about the radio show for 5 minutes, so we can, you know, it's a business expense, right?
That's right.
Is that really dishonest, though, or is that just, what
it
do
is,
you think?
It is really dishonest.
Oh, damn. All right.
So the thing is, what we find is that it's all about our ability to rationalize.
Oh,
that as long
absolutely.
As you can tell yourself a story about why this is actually okay. So what you don't want to do is you don't want to think of yourself as a bad person. You don't want to think of yourself as a dishonest person.
Right, because so, you're either all good or all not, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So we think of ourselves in binary terms. So as long mm-hmm. as you can behave badly but still think of yourself as a good person, you'll go ahead and do it. So if you can say things like, everybody else is doing it, this is what the tax people really intended, this is actually for the best of the company, I actually got good advice from that person. I mean, as long as you can tell a story, you'll go ahead and do it. So in our experiments, we find the same thing. We find that if people think that everybody else is doing it, or if they think that they're stealing from a bad entity,
mm-hmm.
or if they think that they have been harmed before and it's unfair, and by doing that they're kind of restoring justice, or if they don't know who they're hurting, or all of those things basically help justifying bad behavior, and therefore people behave worse.
Oh, gosh. Here, I've got so many questions coming through. It's crazy. Jim from Swampscott would like to know, why can't I stay on my diet at night? I'm fine during the day, but after 9 p.m., it seems like all bets are off. Well,
yeah.
I have that problem too, Jim.
Yeah, so this is what's called depletion.
Yeah.
And depletion is the notion that as we exercise self-control, as we try to resist temptation, so the world is tempting, right? That's not news. And the world is designed to tempt us. If you think about it, the goal of almost every entity outside in the world is trying to tempt you, right? Dunkin' Donuts want you to buy another donut today. Facebook wants you to sign another time to Facebook today. All the things around us want us to do something for them in the short term, right? The only organization that might care about our long-term well-being is maybe our significant others,
mm-hmm.
maybe insurance, maybe preventative care, but of course we don't have preventative care. But mostly it's really about the world is trying to tempt us to do things that are good for other parties in the world. And the question is, how able are we to fight? We're not very good at fighting it. Depletion is the notion that as we fight temptation, it becomes harder and harder for us.
Yes.
It's like a muscle.
No wonder. That's why probably so many people go off their diets, right?
That's right. And that's what happens at night. It's basically through the day, you resist temptation. So you resist a muffin. And then you resist something, a cake. And then you resist sending your boss a nasty email. And then you resist and resist and resist. And every time you resist, really good for you. But at the same time, you have also decreased your ability to fight temptation later. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that as you accumulate all of this ability to resist, you're also reducing your ability to fight later. And at night, it's a really amazing time for people to basically fail.
And one glass of wine and, really all bets are off, right? My listeners know my cracker story. They're probably so sick of hearing it. But, I find that, I'm going to be good. I'm really going to be good. And then I'll just have a couple of crackers. I don't know why, but inevitably, I end up eating the whole damn sleeve. Drives me crazy,
Yeah, and that's another thing. This is kind of a slippery slope, right? Yeah. That basically, and there are two things. One is that the moment you taste something, it actually increases your craving for it.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Don't even think about just having one bite of that cupcake, right?
Right. And that's, by the way, why some things are a little easier than others. So, for example, stopping smoking is very, very tough. Mm-hmm. But in some sense, it's easier than dieting because you're either a smoker or a non-smoker. You know where you stand.
That's right. And you've made dieting, a conscious decision, a real, right?
Yeah. Whereas dieting is really it's always about the next forkful. It's really unclear at what page your diet. I'll tell you what I did for dieting. I travel a lot. And when traveling, it's really tough to eat well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I made two rules for myself, and the first rule is that I don't eat dessert unless it's the weekend, right? And it's basically not about eating more or eating less. It's just that's the rule. And the second thing that helped a little. Oh, the second rule is I don't drink any soft drinks,
right?
Zero ever, right? And that's an easy rule to have.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think so.
And then the other rule I created is that when I travel, I don't eat bread.
Mm-hmm. That's a killer.
And I don't have any kind of a problem with bread, and I love bread. But the thing is that sandwiches are kind of interesting because it is so easy to eat them very quickly.
Yeah.
And when you're in airports, the temptation to eat badly and to eat sandwiches are just very, very high. So I basically have this rule for myself, and by having it as a strict rule, I don't question myself. It's a little easier. Mm-hmm. And also, it doesn't deplete me. Why? Because there's lots of things I just don't consider. So it's not as if I think about them and say, oh, do I want this? Do I not want that? And then I deplete my ability to resist temptation. I just don't consider them because it's part of my rule.
Hey, guys, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talk with Francesca, and I'm speaking with Dan Ariely, who was a professor of psychology at Duke University. This is also fascinating, and these listeners aren't giving me a chance to ask the questions that I want to ask. What I want to know is cheating contagious?
Yes.
Is it?
Very sadly it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
the reason is because we follow other people.
We follow other people, exactly.
So what happens is if you see somebody misbehaving, all of a sudden you think it's more appropriate. And you can. This happens when people throwing trash on the ground, and it happens with all kinds of things and all kinds of bad behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what happens, and it's really, really sad.
Dan, I've got a question about making purchases, where you're so involved in behavioral economics. What are some questions we could ask ourselves when we're making purchases? I know I just bought a blender the other day, and it was, real high-end blender. And then I was reading your book last night, and it occurred to me, and I was like, wait a minute. I got it on sale, but why do I need to spend so much money on a blender? to begin with. And so, you know, I really was kind of fascinated with that thought process. I mean, it's a great blender. You know, it is not a, you know, Kmart blender or whatever. But still, I thought, did I really need to spend that much money on it? And
So here's the
thing. And I said, yes. But I do a lot with my blender. I mean, I make smoothies. Yep. I make soups. You know, I do a lot. So, you know.
And by the way, the answer to should I buy something is not always no. Sometimes you should buy something. Mm-hmm. But I would say that there are, look, money is all about opportunity cost. Every time you spend money on one thing, it's coming up from something else. And that something else could come from something else you could buy right now or come from your savings. And I think we need to think more deliberatively about what we're giving up, right? So if you look at yourself and you say, you know what, at the rate I'm going right now, I'm not going to retire at the level that I wished I would. So if I buy something now, what am I not going to get?
Good question.
And that thing that you're not going to get might be now, might be later. But the reality is that decisions about money are always trade-offs. But we need to bring the trade-off more front to center. So imagine every day you woke up and I gave you cash to spend just for the day. Right? Your trade-offs will become very clear for you. If you buy coffee, you can't take the bus. If you take a cab, you can't have dinner and so on. The problem with modern money, money where we have credit cards and mortgages and student loans and so on, is that it's really hard for us to understand the trade-offs. If you go ahead and spend another $1,000 on a blender, I know you didn't spend $1,000, where is it coming from? It's really hard for you to imagine. But nevertheless, even though it's hard for us to imagine, we do need to go through some of that exercise. And I don't think we can go through this exercise in a full way, in an ideal way, but at least we need to do a slightly better job on thinking about where the money is coming from. So if you bought this blender, you should think to yourself, you know, what else could you spend money on? And is really this the best way to spend money?
I love my new blender.
Very good.
Andrea from Milford wants to know, what about karma? Do you think it has any bearing on what people do?
Karma?
Karma.
I'm a big believer in karma.
But that's your belief system, right? Then again, she wants to know, so go. Go ahead.
But I'll tell you what karma I think is. I think that karma is about the fact that you're willing to do things for the world and you recognize that sometimes it would come back to you and sometimes not. So karma is the law of cause and effect, and it's basically saying there's some randomness in the world, but if you would behave in a better way, good things might come out for you. And I think it's about, we have lots of research showing that there are lucky people and unlucky people. And the way luck works is that it's not that some people go to Vegas and win more money and other people don't consistently. That's not the luck. There are some people who try more things. Like think about two people playing basketball. Mm-hmm. One is shooting a lot. One is shooting very infrequently, right? The guy shoots a lot. From time to time, things would happen to them.
Yeah.
So if you're an open person and you try lots of things and you meet lots of people and you try lots of things and you try new adventure, there's a good chance that some more good things would happen to you because from time to time you will discover things you really like and meet really wonderful people and so on. And I think karma is like that. Karma is basically about being open to the world and saying it's my responsibility to do good. And sometimes it will work out and sometimes it would not. But if you do more of that, there's an odd that good things would happen back.
Well, you know, this is great timing here because Mary from Plymouth would like to know, do you really think that talk therapy ever helps anyone really?
So there are some evidence for a very specific one. So what's called behavioral cognitive therapy, for example, works.
Right.
And things like desensitization, where people have a phobia for cockroaches or something specific. So those things work very well. I think the more open-ended question is, you know, is spending time on the sofa talking about your mother and your upbringing, is that helpful? And I think the evidence on that is not there.
That's pretty dated, I would say, that type of talk.
Yeah, but I think there's lots of very specific things that are helpful that you could basically say, here is something that my mind is just not doing correctly. and let me try and do it again. And there's also recent, very interesting work recently on mindfulness, not my research, but they're showing, for example, that even drug addicts, heroin addicts, if they can train themselves to think about the drug in different ways, they have an easier time to resist temptation. So I think there are, you know, our mind is an is a mechanism that reinterprets the world. And the question is, how do we help it reinterpret the world in a way that is more conducive to long-term happiness? And I think there are some things we can do about it.
Oh, Dan, we just have so many questions, but so little time. We've got to wrap things up. How can my listeners get a hold of you? Or you have a Wall Street Journal column, is that right?
I have a Wall Street Journal column every other weekend. I give advice. It's called Ask Ariely. I have a website, www.danariely.com. So my name, Dan Ariely. And I have information and lectures, and people can read stuff. And
fantastic. Yep. And you're on our recommended reading page. Your book is fantastic. Predictably Irrational. I love it. And The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Francesca. All right. We've got to wrap things up. Thanks for listening. Keep your questions coming. Write to me and let me know what's on your mind. Got to go. See you later. Make it a fantastic week.
Don't try so.
If you're anything like me, your dog is no different than your child. That's when I can't take my fur baby with me, I bring him to Goodfellas Doggy Daycare at 20 Thresher Street right on Route 1 North in Saugus. They offer separate play areas for big and small dogs, a full-size saltwater swimming pool, and top-notch training from puppy to adult. Goodfellas Doggy Daycare, we're your family. And with them, it's personal. Visit GoodfellasDoggyDaycare.com today.
Brown Sugar by the Sea is unique to the area with a contemporary, creative, healthy take on traditional Thai cuisine. You'll find well-known favorites, as well as some unexpected goodies stemming from far-flung regions of Thailand. Fresh vegetables, bright flavors, and herbs stand out in every Brown Sugar dish and can be delivered conveniently to your door or enjoyed in their warm and welcoming dining room. A full bar, a pizzazzy cocktail menu, live music on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and a smiling, knowledgeable staff will make your Brown Sugar experience perfectly sweet. So visit Brown Sugar by the Sea for an unforgettable experience from start to finish. You'll be glad you did. Brown Sugar by the Sea, 75 Water Street in Newburyport, or visit them at brownsugarbythesea.com.
It's time to refresh the look of your home. You have some ideas on how you want it to look, but you don't know where to start. You need someone who can work with the styles you like and the ideas you have to make it all happen. Someone who will help you avoid costly mistakes and overspending on the wrong stuff. Pick up the phone and call Vered Rosen today. She's one of the most experienced interior designers in Greater Boston, and she's always there to help you. Call 617-584-9965 or at VeredRosenDesign.com.
Tides is beachside dining at its best all year round. Located at the end of the Nahant Causeway, directly on Nahant Beach, the ocean views from the dining room and the pub can't be beat, no matter what the season. Nominated for Best of the North Shore from North Shore Magazine for Best Alfresco Dining, Best Kid-Friendly Restaurant, Best Lobster Dinner, and Best Water View. Why would you go anywhere else? Whether you choose their dining room, a frosty pint at their bar, or a sun-drenched deck on Nahant Beach, they guarantee you great atmosphere with super food and service. Their menu is full of fresh, high-quality seafood, prime rib, chicken, pasta, and pizza that everyone will love. Check out their drink menu for fun cocktails, 30 ice-cold beers on tap, and their well-rounded wine list with their state-of-the-art tap wines. They feature full-service lottery and keno. Tides is the place to watch any big game. They have over 20 HD TVs. At Tides, they specialize in casual dining with food that's just delicious, not pretentious. Tides is a fantastic restaurant anytime, summer or winter, lunch or dinner, rain or shine.
Located in Boston's North End holds one of our best-kept secrets, Antico Forno, ranked number 9 of the top 10 Italian restaurants around the world within the category of being one of the most authentic. With a welcoming family feel, it's hard to argue the experience you have when enjoying dinner at Antico Forno. Best known for their brick oven pizza, their world-class traditional cuisine does not fall far behind. Come enjoy dinner at Antico Forno and feel like part of the family. Open daily from 11:30 a.m. until 10 p.m. Call us today at 617 723 323-6733 or visit us at AnticoFornoBoston.com.